ओम नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय ओम नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय ओम नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय Hare Krishna. Welcome to our guests. Good evening. Okay, so today we are reading from Srimad Bhagavad Gita, chapter 2, verse 28. Avyakta dini bhutani Vaktyamadhyani Bharata Avyakta Nidhananyeva Tatraka Paridevana Avyakta Dini Bhutani Vyaktamadhyani Bharata Avyakta Nidhananyeva Tatraka Paridevana Avyakta Dini Bhutani Vyaktamadhyani Bharata Avyakta Nidhananyeva Tatraka Paridevana Avyakta Dini Bhutani Avyakta Dini Bharata Avyakta Nindananyeva Tatraka Paridevana Avyakta Dini Bhutani Vyakta Madhyani Bharata Avyakta Nidhananyeva Tatraka Paridevana Avyakta Dini Bhutani Vyakta Madhyani Bharata Avyakta Nidhananyeva Tatraka Paridevana Avyakta Dini Bhutani Vyakta Madhyani Bharata Avyakta Nidhananyeva Avyakta Nidhananyeva Tatraka Paridevana Avyakta Dini Bhutani Vyakta Madhyani Bharata Avyakta Nidhananyeva Tatraka Paridevana Avyakta Dini In the beginning unmanifested Bhutani, all that are created. Vyakta, manifested. Madhyani, in the middle. Bharata, O descendant of Bharata. avyakta, non-manifested, nindanani, when vanquished, eva, it is all like that, tadra, therefore, ka, what, parideva-na, lamentation. All created beings are unmanifest in their beginning, manifest in their interim state, and unmanifest again when annihilated. So what then? So what need is there for lamentation? So let's repeat. All created beings are unmanifest in their beginning, manifest in their interim state, and unmanifest again when annihilated. So what need is there for lamentation? Purport. Accepting that there are two classes of philosophers, one believing in the existence of the soul and the other not believing in the existence of the soul, there is no cause for lamentation in either case. Thank you. Thank you. Non-believers in the existence of the soul are called atheists by followers of Vedic wisdom. Yet even for argument's sake, if we accept this atheistic theory, there is still no cause for lamentation. Apart from the separate existence of the soul, the material elements remain unmanifested before creation. From this subtle state of non-manifestation comes manifestation. Just as from ether, air is generated. From air, fire is generated. From fire, water is generated. And from water, earth becomes manifested. From the earth, many varieties of manifestations take place. Take, for example, a big skyscraper, manifested from the earth. When it is dismantled, the manifestation becomes again unmanifested and remains as atoms in the ultimate stage. The law of conservation of energy remains. But in course of time, things are manifested and unmanifested. That is the difference. Then, what cause is there for lamentation, either in the stage of manifestation or unmanifestation? Somehow or other, even in the unmanifested stage, things are not lost, both at the beginning and at the end. All elements remain unmanifested, and only in the middle are they manifested. And this does not make any real material difference. And if we accept the Vedic conclusion as stated in the Bhagavad Gita, that these material bodies are perishable in due course of time, and that the soul is eternal, then we must remember always that the body is like a dress. Therefore, why lament the changing of a dress? The material body has no factual existence in relation to the eternal soul. It is something like a dream. In a dream, we may think of flying in the sky or sitting in a chariot as a king. But when we wake up, we can see that we are neither in the sky nor seated on the chariot. The Vedic wisdom encourages self-realization on the basis of non-existence of the material body. Therefore, in either case, whether one believes in the existence of the soul or one does not believe in the existence of the soul, there is still no cause for lamentation for the loss of the body. The verse speaks mainly about change from manifest to unmanifest and again, manifest and again, unmanifest and again. It sort of seems like a cyclic motion that we go through from manifest and unmanifest states. And then Krishna is speaking this verse. So he asks the question, so what need is there for lamentation if this process is going on of manifesting and unmanifesting and manifesting again and unmanifesting? And in the previous verse, it's pretty much the same idea, the same notion, that one has to go through these manifest and unmanifest states due to one's past activities or karma. These stages are going to come again and again and again unless we make some concerted effort to try and put an end to this manifest and unmanifest states. If we make a sincere effort towards getting out of the repeated cycle of birth and death. In the purport, Srila Prabhupada starts by making a distinction about two different types of philosophers. According to the Vedic version, the soul, an eternal fragment of the Supreme Lord, exists, and the soul is present within the material body. However, there is also another class of philosophers being spoken about here, and that class is known as the atheists, simply because they don't believe in the existence of the soul. And here Krishna is speaking about these different classes of people. He's saying whether you believe that there is a soul or not, you still shouldn't lament. Because what would you be lamenting for then? Just the body. And since this body is going to go through its unmanifest and manifested state and unmanifest again, why are you lamenting, Arjuna? All your relatives, everyone that you're looking at there, right now they're in this middle stage, in this manifest stage. Only in the middle are they manifested, and it does not make any real material difference because in the beginning and the end, they're unmanifested. There is one line that really struck me in the purport. But before we go to that, I'll just explain a little bit about the state. Prabhupada speaks about ether, and from ether air. So he speaks about creation, basically, in this part of the purport. He speaks about how from subtle elements, the gross elements are manifest. Something as fine and subtle as ether, which is what we know of as a vacuum, like all of outer space, the ethereal region. This is what we call a vacuum. But actually it's made up of ether. Ether is such a fine and subtle substance. And from that subtle substance comes air, which is a little more gross than ether. And this is our ozone layer that surrounds the earth. This is the air, the oxygen, and all the other fine gases that make up the air that we need to survive. And from air, fire is generated. So air we cannot see, but from air comes fire. Fire we can see, so it's a little more gross than air. Fire you can touch, you can feel, you know the presence of air by wind. But fire you can already see, and you can feel. And from fire, water is generated. From fire we have a byproduct here, as stated, water. So from fire you can get steam. And by that you can see the presence of water. Water from fire. And from water, earth becomes manifested. So from this kind of water, precipitation, and then it rains, and then you have earth. Something as gross as earth being manifested. And it said that these layers, they are progressively, that many yojanas, thicker by diameter. You have the gross and then more subtle and more subtle and more subtle, and in ether or space, you can see by that many more millions and millions of kilometers and miles and other Vedic measurements, that it's that much more wider than everything else that we know. And as I was thinking about how the purport here is mentioning creation, then he speaks about the law of conservation of energy that remains. Does anyone know anything about the law of conservation of energy? Mm-hmm. Yes. The Srila Prabhupada is actually speaking about laws of physics, laws of nature. And of course, from my own, I was a school kid at some stage, so I studied science and then physics also. So I'm familiar with Newton's laws. And here Prabhupada mentions in just a few words, you know, and he takes it for granted that people should understand what this is. You know, for example, this conservation of energy. He says it remains. So what Srila Prabhupada is actually speaking about when he says this is so deep. It's so scientific. It's so subtle, but at the same time, if you don't know it, you miss it very easily. This law is very, how can I say, very pertinent to explaining this manifest and unmanifested state. Because as Prabhuji mentioned, energy cannot be destroyed, cannot be created either. It says that the soul is not created or destroyed. It's eternal, part and parcel of Krishna. So energy, just like that, in some kind of system, it cannot be mutilated in any kind of way, but it can be transformed. Energy can be transformed so that it may reside in a different state. So sometimes we may have energy in a state where it's not usable yet, and this we call potential energy, which means this energy is stored, and it can change its state. It can transform into something that can be used to do many types of varieties of physical work. So then it becomes kinetic energy, because then it's energy in motion, energy in action. And if I look at a tangible example, we could see, for example, an internal combustion engine of an automobile. It converts the potential chemical energy, which is from stored in the gasoline or the petroleum or diesel, and oxygen, into heat, which is then transformed into the propulsive energy or kinetic energy which moves the vehicle. Actually, there's a whole long, elaborate, very detailed description of how this kind of energy is transformed. There are many steps to the process. And this kind of process is really, I mean, who can imagine that from some subtle volatile liquid, has anyone touched or come into contact with gasoline or petroleum? Can you briefly describe what this liquid is like? Yes, highly flammable. Because the nature of it is that in an instant, in a split second, it's already evaporating. It's how can you say, it's volatility. It's very volatile. It means that the particles, you can smell it in the air. Its nature is that it's almost air-like. So it's very flammable, and yeah, you can definitely smell it around. If you drive into a gas station, you can already smell it, you know, all over the place. But that is the nature of it. Now, how can something like that be able to propel a car or a jet, a 747, for example? They use jet fuel, which is also a very volatile liquid. How is it that the energy from this liquid, if you do not have that liquid, you know, this car, this engine cannot move? How is it that one can explain such stored energy is able to propel or move or cause such motion of these objects, of these bodies? Actually, I think I should go through the sort of detailed process because it makes a very clear point about the point of this verse. The potential energy that's stored within the gas, gasoline or petroleum or diesel, this kind of volatile liquid, there's actually combustion that takes place in the engine. And when that is in contact with a spark, and then there's combustion. And from this combustion, it is propelled. The gas actually expands. Where there's heat, this gas actually expands. And then from potential energy, it's already converted to kinetic energy because the particles move. So from this kinetic energy, there's linear movement caused by the expansion in this gas. And this sort of propels the car's crankshaft, which then, yes, leads to the axle and transmission. Oh yes, transmission is a big thing for a car. It must have gears. How fast will it go? And then from there it goes to the differential. Differential, yes, the wheel, even the wheels in the car. Someone would think that both the wheels, don't they move at the same speed? But even that's not true. The car needs a differential so that one wheel can move at one speed and the other can move at the other. Because if you're making a turn, for example, and straight away you can see already, oh yeah, here's the turn. One wheel needs to go considerably slower than the outer wheel. The inner wheel needs to go slower than the outer wheel. So even something like a car needs to have a differential just to sort of keep it going properly in the right direction, at the right speed, at the right... You get the idea. And then this differential then gets the motion, this rotatory motion going to the drive wheels. And then this driving or rotating motion then propels the car in a linear motion, which means it goes straight forward. First you have this type of motion and this type of energy, and then it's transformed into so many different phases and stages, and then it's finally, okay, you know, moving forward. So just like that, all created beings are unmanifest in the beginning, manifest in the interim state, and unmanifest again. So in one day of Brahma, which is the yugas, the four yugas as we know it, which is many more years than I can count, and many more years than I can express in figures. But it's made up of the four yugas collectively. And the jiva goes through so many stages of transformation. Not the soul itself, but body-wise. The soul never transforms. But yet, we go through all these different phases of being manifest and unmanifest again. Having this potential of being spiritual beings. You know, this potential is never lost. Yet we go through all the 8,400,000 species of life from one age to the next, to the next, to the next. It's that amount of time that it takes us sometimes to go through and make up our minds whether or not we actually want to quit going through the cycle of being unmanifest and manifest and unmanifest again. Actually, it's surprising that Krishna also speaks about these two different types of philosophers here. Because we understand about the soul, and we understand that it exists and it's going through these transformations. But what about the people who don't believe in the soul? What happens with them? Okay, well, I think this argument actually started in verse 25. And it continues until text 30. In verse 25, it began with the words, Atha cha, if however, which indicates that Krishna begins to discuss a new topic in his advice to Arjuna. And Sri Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur explains Krishna's thinking by these words, Atha cha. He says that Krishna says that I have thus far explained things to you, Arjuna, from the point of view of Shastra. Where he speaks about how the soul is eternal and it's this and it's that. So he's explaining all these things to Arjuna in terms of Shastra. And now when he says Atha Cha, he now says, I will explain now these things from the worldly point of view. And this worldly point of view is not necessarily in line with Shastra. For example, Prabhupada says in the purport, non-believers in the existence of the soul are called atheists by followers of Vedic wisdom. So Krishna, up till verse 25, is speaking about Shastric or Vedic wisdom. And then at that point, he starts to speak about the world. Krishna first explained the soul's eternality. And now he argues on the basis of principles that are presented by other philosophers, namely the atheists and the Buddhists, because they also believe that we don't have a soul. But actually, by this kind of philosophy, telling Arjuna, by Krishna is telling Arjuna that, you know what, whether you believe that there is a soul or don't believe that there is a soul, you still should not lament. And by telling Arjuna this, Krishna actually checkmates Arjuna. If anyone is familiar with the game of chess on 64 squares and black and white, and in this game of chess, there are so many times you can make so many different moves. And eventually, the whole idea of the game is to capture the king. So Krishna is doing that with Arjuna. He's sort of moving him by the different evidences, Shastric evidence, and he's giving him worldly evidence. And eventually, he comes to a point where he checkmates Arjuna. Like, okay, Arjuna, now you cannot argue. Either from this perspective or from that perspective. If you look at it this way or that way, you still should not lament, and you should still fight. And how does he checkmate Arjuna? He says, if all the assembled warriors are factually eternal souls, then no one will die on the battlefield. Because if you look at the soul, it cannot die. So if you look at it from the Vedic perspective, and Arjuna, if you fight and kill everyone here, no one is actually dying. And Arjuna should therefore do his duty and fight. But if no soul exists, and life is simply the result of some chemical combinations, then Arjuna should still do his duty and fight. Because if Arjuna accepts the argument for the non-existence of the soul, then he should not be afraid to fight. After all, how can he be a killer of a combination of chemicals? If there is no soul, and all we are is a combination of chemicals, then, you know, why is Arjuna afraid to kill some combination of chemicals? It doesn't make sense. Why are you lamenting for some combination of chemicals then, Arjuna? That's whether the soul exists or not. Arjuna should not lament but should fight. If he's wrong and he thinks that, you know, the Kauravas will not die at all if he refuses to fight, then there's a big fallacy with that also. Because Krishna already said to him that these people are killed by me. You are my mere instrument, Arjuna. So this eternal soul contacts the material body, and that's how it's manifested. And Prabhupada mentions it's an interim state. It's only in the middle phase that it's manifested. And then we have death. And death is described as being an unmanifest state, where the soul is no longer in the body. And immediately one can see at the point of death that the soul is not manifest in the body any longer. Because there is no symptom of consciousness. It's a lifeless body. We hear this phrase again and again. Lifeless. That's what matter is described as. Lifeless, dull, mundane matter. Because it's a bunch of chemicals. But only where there is the soul can we see symptoms of consciousness in a being. Without the soul, everything is dead. Lifeless matter. So Prabhupada drives home this point again and again that we're not this body. we're not. Why? Because can you imagine if we were just a bag of chemicals? It's kind of hard sometimes to picture how people believe that philosophy when you understand that you're spirit soul. But if we hadn't been given that knowledge, if for some reason or the other we were, say, maybe taught in school or given this knowledge by our parents, that we're just a bunch of chemicals. I mean, this kind of theory is being taught in schools today, of the Big Bang theory, that there was a bunch of chemicals and from this primordial soup there came the manifestation of planets after a Big Bang happened. And that there is no creator. And everything is just working under its own direction. Basically, one is evolving from the other, and we don't know how, we don't know why, but it just is. And at some point or the other, it's going to end, or it's not going to end, but actually we don't know. However, there are some things that are so perfectly fine-tuned, and we don't have any explanation for that either. But from the Vedic perspective, we do have an explanation for that. We do know that nothing is happening by absolute chance. And from this perspective, we understand that, yes, because there is a beautiful creation, a machine like a watch or a human body, there must be a creator. Who can just throw up some bunch of chemicals and thereby just have a perfectly functioning watch, a precision instrument like a watch, or the human body, which functions with its own systems within systems? Who can say that some bunch of chemicals can just manufacture something that works so perfectly? There still is not evidence enough to understand the full workings of a lot of our universe. And scientists keep saying that yes, they're almost there. They're just going to solve all the mysteries of the universe and everything, but they're just there. And they've been saying that for years and years and years. And years upon years. And Prabhupada said that's always going to be their argument. Because they can never know everything that there is to know about the universe and manifested universes. Because our universe is just one little tiny mustard seed in a bag of thousands and thousands of mustard seeds. That's how big the actual creation is. Our universe is just but one, tiny, in a multitude of thousands of universes. Because Krishna is not limited to create just one universe with one earth and one sphere with, you know, one species of human beings. No, it's really narrow to think that we're the only ones in the world, let alone the universe or the cosmos. Okay, so from the cosmos, back to the verse. Yeah. So Vedic wisdom encourages self-realization on the basis of the non-existence of the material body. So the word non-existence, I was just wondering, okay, we are conditioned beings who think in terms of everything that we can see and perceive and touch and feel and, you know, within the range of our senses. So how do we explain then non-existence of the material body? Anyone? I mean, it's clearly stating here non-existence, but I'm here, I can see me. You're here, Madhugopa, I can see you. I can see everyone in the room. How is this non-existence? No, it's an explanation to an example. The example is of a dream. So Prabhupada is actually explaining that. Because material life is actually explained in terms of a dream. It said in the spiritual world, we were there. Now we're here. For this many lifetimes and lifetimes and lifetimes and, you know, unmanifest and manifesting bodies and unmanifest again. But actually, it says that we've only left the spiritual world for like 1 second. And yet it feels like eons and lifetimes of unlimited births and deaths and unmanifest and manifest states that we have to go through. And that whole process that I just described about internal combustion energy, energy cycle within an engine, whether it comes from gasoline and going through the differential and, you know, this axle and that axle and causing emotion, blah, blah, blah. And then we look at this whole journey of the soul takes, going through so many different species of life and ups and downs and ins and outs and manifest and unmanifest. And yet, in a spiritual world, it's just, you've just been gone for a second, a fraction of time. And it feels like a dream. Has anyone had any experience of dreams? Nightmares? You know, it's so real when you're in it. In the dream, okay, alright. Your experience is it feels like this is reality. This is you. You're in the dream. And sometimes you don't understand that you're in the dream. It's like you're in living your life. But it's a dream. And sometimes we get so caught up in the dream that, you know, once we wake up again, we actually see either the tears or, you know, we're still afraid, we're shivering, our hair standing on end. Such is the experience. It's so lifelike. We can actually almost say that, yeah, it was happening. But Prabhupada's example here is of a king in a chariot. Flying in the sky or sitting on a chariot as a king. But when we wake up from the dream, when we actually get back to our state of consciousness, we understand that it was just a dream. Yet it may have felt so real, but we understand that it was just a dream. So this point of non-existence of the material body is explained in such a similar way. From the point of eternity, this body is non-existent. The only thing that is existent is the eternal soul. Yet, because we're in the material plane, we're using material sense perception, such as sight, taste, touch. Yeah, this body exists for the time being. Yet, from the standpoint of eternity, as the verse speaks about being manifest, this is the middle point, the manifestation point of being unmanifest, manifest, and unmanifest again. When there is annihilation, it will be unmanifest. When the soul loses contact with the material body, it will be unmanifest. Just like a dream. Okay, we'll stop here. Is there any questions, comments, corrections? Dreams. Hope it was okay for our guests. Really technical. Malu, shall I wait?
Could you explain it one more time? Why is it called the body non-existent? Just what the whole text is about. I mean, Krishna is giving material example. Mm-hmm. You know, okay, the soul is eternal, so if you feel them, then you don't need to feel them, because you can't feel the soul. But then he's saying, even if you don't believe in the soul, even if you kill the body, it's manifested and then unmanifested, so it will be unmanifested, so you might
Yeah, because that's part of your duty to do it, Arjuna. It has no factual existence in relation to the eternal soul. I think that's the line you're looking for. It comes here. When we must remember that the body is like a dress, therefore why lament the changing of a dress? The material body has no factual existence in relation to the eternal soul. It is something like a dream. So that's the example that Prabhupada is giving, the dream example. So if it's a dress, you know, how many dresses, how many outfits, how many items of clothing does a single individual possess? Come on, Madhu, how many sets of clothes do you have? So, from that kind of idea that, okay, we have clothes, we all have a different kind of dress. And if there's something wrong with the dress, either it has a hole or a stain or a tear, or we just don't like it anymore, we get rid of it. We don't keep it with us. You know, it's not in a state where it can be usable anymore. It's of no service to us. So then we change it. So just like that, the body, when it either reaches a state where it's no longer useful, or it's in a state of breaking down, or whether it's our karma at that point or the other due to our past activities that we need to leave this particular body, then we got to leave it. Just like a dress. If you have too much weight at the airport when you're coming back from Vrindavan Dham after shopping at Loy Bazaar, you can't take everything. You have to leave some things behind. You have to leave at that state your favorite saris or whatever, you know. It's like that, the body, although we may have developed some kind of attraction or affection for it, it's simply equated to a dress. And we've changed it so many times, so many lifetimes, again and again and again. Different colors, different shades, different sizes, different forms. It's not like the dress has any feeling, any emotion, any substance. It's something that was not manifest at one stage. From the earth, from the practical elements, it's grown from some cotton field, in some cotton field from somewhere. So this cotton is spun, it goes through a process, eventually it ends up like a cloth, something wearable. And after some time, it wears out and disintegrates, and these elements are back. As we were speaking about energy, the rule of conservation, the law of energy, is that energy can never be destroyed or created. But material stuff goes through this manifested and unmanifested state. Whereas energy, if it's likened to the spirit soul, it's something eternal. It can never be in this, you know, up, down, and degraded stage. Only matter goes through that kind of transformation. And then, you were asking about the non-existence. That was the question that I asked in the end. How is it, then, that this material body, which we can factually see in front of us, is considered non-existent? Because from the standpoint of eternality, if we're looking at it from the platform of the soul and eternality, it is non-existent. It's here for just a very short time and then gone again. From this unmanifested state, it's here for the middle phase. Both the beginning and at the end, this unmanifested stage is there. But in the middle, this short material difference appears. And then it's unmanifest again. It's very short. It's at the end of the first paragraph of the purport. And yet Prabhupada says somehow or other, even in the unmanifested stage, things are not lost. Because there again, he speaks from the standpoint of eternality. It's not lost, although it's unmanifest. It's not lost at all. Is that okay, ma'am? Anyone else? Yes, that's completely in line. I think in science of self-realization there's also another example. Prabhupada speaks about a mother, and she's in the kitchen and she's cooking, and the daughter, who's very young, wants to follow the mother's example, and she wants to also cook. But of course she's too young and without the knowledge to actually do what the mother is doing. So the mother gets her a little playset, a little kitchenette of her own, so she can play cook. So the child is not actually cooking, but at the same time, she's cooking. If you understand that analogy. She has plastic spoons and forks and a plastic cooking pot. And, you know, she's there and she's thinking, I'm cooking, you know. Whereas only the mother is actually doing the cooking. But yet the child is in a state where they believe this, you know, with conviction. Yeah, I'm cooking just like my mother. And Srila Prabhupada likens that to us, Jiva, where we want to be Krishna. Ultimately, the reason why we left there is that we wanted to be Krishna. There's this analogy of the big fish and the little fish. There's actually a drama, a really good drama. And it actually shows where the jiva wants to be Krishna. Like, I want to be the big fish. There's one big fish and a whole shoal. Like, all the other jivas are the shoals of other fishes that are following the big fish. Where Krishna, we know, is in the center of the spiritual world. Actually, he's in the center of all the worlds, but, you know, just for the example. Here's Krishna, and he's a big fish, and there's a whole big shoal of other fish that are following him. And one day one fish decides, well, why can't I be the big fish? And then, phew, Krishna gives you a little fishbowl, and you want to be the big fish? Here you go. Go ahead. Try and be this Ishvara that you want to be in your own little fishbowl. Make play. Scenario. You want to cook? Okay, here you go. Here's your own scenario where you can try to cook up something. But eventually, when we come to the understanding, just like when we grow up, we understand that what we were doing as kids was just play. Like when we wake up from the dream, we understand that we were dreaming. So just like that, when we understand from the true point of eternality, then we understand and we see how it's non-existent. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Possibly. I don't know very much about deity worship just yet, but I would guess so. Yeah, from very subtle elements to it's a very, very interesting observation. Yeah, could be very interesting to follow that up, but I personally don't know anything directly linked to that. But I guess we try to always offer Krishna the best of everything. So maybe, maybe not, if there's a link. But yeah. Yeah, please. Thank you, Sharma. Okay. If that, yep. Hare Krishna. Shri Gurudev and Shri Prabhupada ki. Granthana Srimad Bhagavad Gita ki.